So yeah, just hand those assignments down the line. And let's see. Wonderful. I must say it is a joy to sit and go through these assignments. You know, it's kind of neat to just watch kind of what's going on as you guys work through these passages. And I hope, I try to put comments on there that are both encouraging but also constructive, to say, hey, here's some ideas, some areas to watch for, to look at. So I hope you're finding that to be really beneficial and helpful to you as you work through it. I also realize what's kind of neat is some areas that I haven't emphasized as well or haven't talked about. So even some of the things here at the start of our lecture tonight, I realized as I was looking, there was a great uniformity to where at the end of this, I'm like, surely. And then I realized, no, I haven't talked about that yet. That's why some of those connections aren't being made. So we're gonna tackle some of that here together tonight. For next time, your assignment, you're going to get a reprieve. In case you were thinking, oh, 1 Thessalonians, 3 more laps. I mean, really, how many times can one circle through 1 Thessalonians? Next week, you get some new landscape, some new geography, get to look around in some new places, okay? And so your reading assignment for this next upcoming week is Proverbs chapter 30, verses 18 through 31. And what I'm asking you to do is to read through it 3 times, but on 3 separate days. Now, these are pretty short stretches, okay? So, you know, you're, again, think about different ways of reading as you go about reading Proverbs 30, 18 through 31. But the idea is I want you to kind of dig in, because it's a different type of literature. The way Proverbs works, the way Proverbs communicates, is not going to look the same as 1 Thessalonians. And so I want you to really spend some time orienting yourself and even thinking through, how do I read Proverbs as a whole? Okay, but for this week, Proverbs chapter 30, also Psalm 19. So Psalm 19, and you'll notice then that in conjunction with that, you have your 4 journals. So you'll get some new meditation material here to take and apply in your journals, but also your observations now are going to funnel into Proverbs and Psalm 19. And we're going to talk through tonight different types of literature. We've looked a lot at narrative and epistles. Those are kind of the easiest 2 to start with. They also happen to be the majority of the Bible. But tonight, in particular, we're going to look at prophecy, Proverbs, and Psalms, and some unique things that will help your observation skills in those particular styles and types of literature. But that's your assignment for next week. Any questions about the assignments for next week? Clear as mud. That's right. All right, good. So I want to hear from you. Talk to me a little bit. I think it was 2 weeks ago that I asked you about your observations in 1 Thessalonians. You've taken several more laps. You've summarized, synthesized your ideas in headings, and you've made at least 20 observations, I believe, from each chapter now in 1 Thessalonians. And I'm curious, what are some of the things that the Lord is really showing you as you've gone through it this week? This is the time for you to talk so I can finish my coffee. That's right. Not at all. I'm getting warmed both in my belly and in my soul here. So bless me, please. Yeah, there you go. Come on, guys. What have you been seeing? What have you been observing and learning as you study 1 Thessalonians?
That I thought, as far as the theme goes, that it felt like it was very apparent throughout Thessalonians that the church and and the specific people within the Thessalonian church had been set apart specifically by God, starting with, you know, to some degree, starting with Paul and his, I'd say, anxiety at first, that he kind of, he's with the Thessalonians, but probably not for quite long enough. He sees their conversion, but then he leaves, and he knows they're being persecuted, and he's worried about, you know, what does this mean? Like, what will happen to them? And then the response back is very clear that their faith is as strong as ever, which has to be miraculous, right? And it seems like for Paul to even be surprised, like, I was surprised, but for Paul to even be surprised, it's got to be fairly miraculous. It was almost like him seeing something that he knew, that God really called these people specifically, but to know it and to realize it are two different things, or to know it and see it in practice. And then after that, they still seem to be set apart, or the theme seems to be that they're set apart, both in Paul instructing them on how to live as though they're different, right? To be people of the day, not people of the night, and to be anticipating Christ coming back. So you can almost see these people living the way that Paul wants them to be, working. You know, his instructions are, you know, be hard workers, be diligent, right? To be supporting yourselves and taking care of yourselves so that you can be this kind of set apart people that are waiting for Christ to come back. And that was kind of the theme that I saw through the whole thing.
Yeah, isn't it? I mean, how many of you have lived in a different place and maybe you've had dear Christian brothers and sisters that were part of the church there that you had a special relationship with, or maybe you even had the opportunity to see someone come to faith while you were in that particular place? I know for us, having lived in Dallas for 4 years, right, there are those kinds of relationships. But then the Lord moves you geographically quite some distance, and you're separated to where you can't be there day in and day out. And so to take Paul's heart and kind of this constant burden for the faith and the health and well-being of this church is remarkable, because I know it's very easy to get caught up in the here and in the now, right, and to seldom think of even the dearest of people from a previous segment of your life. And yet Paul is constantly, he's sending, right, he sends Timothy back at great cost to himself, frankly. I mean, you think of this, right? Here's Paul. He's stepping into, in Acts 17, the language that describes Athens is not, your pleasure cruise, right? This is a very hostile environment spiritually for Paul. He just feels the oppression of the demon pagan worship in Athens. And yet, he would rather be alone and send off than to keep Timothy and Silas with him. Remarkable, remarkable concern and compassion for those believers.
I guess, you know, what came to my mind in reading it was, in terms of an example, and probably an example of people that misapply it, but still, I was just reminded of Amish people. Like, when in some of his, you know, be these people that kind of keep your head down and work hard, and people of the day, you know, like, you can kind of see that in Amish people. They kind of really set themselves apart to a degree that's not healthy, but in some ways they really kind of embody some of these things. And then obviously forget about lots of other biblical truths, but that was, it just kind of reminded me of that. Also Puritans to some degree also.
Yeah, and there's that slogan, right? You're so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good. But maybe it was penned with the Thessalonians. I don't know. But the idea is, right, they think Christ is coming back so quickly. It's like a career. I mean, if Jesus is coming back tomorrow, why do I need to work? I got enough to live at least till tomorrow or this week or maybe even a few months. So, yeah. Why work, right? And so you see that their work ethic is being shaped by their view of Christ and his return and future things even. Excellent. Other thoughts from 1 Thessalonians?
Was I reading Acts right that he only had 3 weeks there? That he taught for 3 Sabbaths.
Yeah, we know for sure he's there for three Sabbaths. There's, if you start to look at commentators and this sort of thing, you're going to find, Tim, that they'll say a minimum of 3 weeks, as much as a year. So, I mean, we know of the three Sabbaths for sure in Acts, but that's all we have. It doesn't appear that he's there long. I tend to think it's on the shorter end, a month tops probably, and he's on, just given the hastiness with which they chase him to Berea, and it doesn't seem like they're the kind that are going to let this go for 3 months. I mean, if they're going to chase him down the road to Berea, I tend to believe he's on the road pretty quick. But you'll see, I think up to a year is what some might allow there. Yes, Pat.
Because all of our righteousness is as filthy rags. They attach the two together. And I know, and I think it's all about God. And he did, he so loved us that he gave such a great price. And it's difficult for me to see how that one can have a healthy spiritual perspective of who they are. If they're forever saying, it's all about God, it's not about us. And to me, Paul really, for me personally, shed light on how that, it is about them. It's about them being established, about me caring about them. I see so much to the point that I'm not there, but I'm sending someone up there to make sure that they are nurtured and taken care of. And I don't think that's just a one-time experience until they continue to mature and grow.
And you see, Pat, now here's something that's really, really powerful, because you see it back with Abraham, and you definitely see it here with Paul and his relationship to these folks, that God, in bestowing blessing, in giving graciously, undeservedly, right, he does that not so that we are the recipients, but actually he desires to have that come in us and then through us to reach others. And really, this whole letter is a beautiful picture of that, because the gospel first came to Paul, transforms Paul, but then through Paul and his proclamation of the gospel reaches this church. And then what happens? It doesn't stop with the Thessalonians, right? It's now spreading to all of Macedonia. And so you see, Pat, that God is giving, is working, is sovereignly orchestrating in human lives, through human lives, to reach other human lives. And this is why Paul can say, be imitators of me, because it's God in him. And this is the wonder of God, that he would take on human flesh. And you think about this for just a minute. I'm going to get on a little sermon here for just a minute, right? But God would manifest his glory in the temple so that both his own people, Israel, but also the nations around would know this is where God dwells. But then notice, right, he comes later on, and in Ezekiel, the glory of the Lord departs from the temple because the rebellion and the wickedness and idolatry is so great. They're bringing the idols into the temple. The glory of the Lord descends out the temple, up the Mount of Olives, gone. And Israel's left wondering, where is the glory of the Lord? Will it come back? Well, John 1 answers that question, right? The glory of the Lord returns, but in the person of Jesus Christ. And as John 1:14 says, the glory of the Lord tabernacles now in human flesh. But that's not the end of the story either, because that's God's glory tabernacling in all its fullness in Jesus. But Jesus says, you know what? It's for your good that I go away. Well, how can that be? How can it be good that the glory of God now in human flesh, so I have an even greater, more tangible understanding and expression of it? How can that be possible? Well, what comes next? Jesus says, I must go so that the Helper, the Holy Spirit, the Comforter might come. And as 2 Corinthians 3 speaks of, right? Moses used to behold the glory of the Lord with an unveiled face, and his face would kind of shine, and the Israelites were like, oh, this is freaking us out. Put the veil on, Moses. We can't handle this. And 2 Corinthians 3 says, now we with unveiled face behold as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, and that glory now reflects and resonates from within us through the Spirit that lives in us. And so the glory of God is shining and resonating and alive in each and every one of our hearts. And it's powerfully represented, right, as the community of faith works together and serves together and is united through that Spirit, but also gifted to be the fullness of Christ, Ephesians 4 tells us. But also it shines that glory for others to see, for a perishing world to see. And it's powerful because it is, Pat, I don't want to deny that it's all about God. But God, in the beauty of his plan and purposes, chooses to use us. That's the amazing thing. Why? I mean, a rebellious lot, a group that has done nothing but fight against his plan and his purposes, and yet God says, I will use these broken vessels, these jars of clay, to accomplish my purposes and to shine my glory. You know, I just this morning, I was in Ezekiel, and this just, it really, really struck me this morning. Let me just share this with you. This wasn't, as Piper always says, this wasn't in the manuscript, but we'll throw this in anyway. Ezekiel 38, God says, I will magnify myself, sanctify myself, and make myself known in the sight of many nations, and they will know that I am the Lord. And I thought, wow, what a powerful declaration. God says, I will exalt myself, magnify myself, I will set myself apart. There is no God like Yahweh. There's no God like me. I'm going to distinguish myself from all the idols, all the idolatry that's running rampant in Ezekiel. And I will make myself known, notice, not in a vacuum, but among the nations. And if God is doing that for himself, what is he going to do to the people that are connected to him, right? That very same thing. He's going to exalt himself. He's going to set apart his name, because the people that are connected to him are going to be different than people connected to other gods. That's the whole idea. And this is on the heels, right, of Ezekiel 36 and 37, where I'm going to put my Spirit within them. They'll have a new heart, like this valley of dry bones. I'm going to breathe new life into this dry, dead bone. So anyway, I get fired up. This is great, great stuff. Thanks for sharing that, Pat. What else are you guys seeing in 2 Thessalonians? I still have more coffee here, so.
So for in the chapter 3, verse 10, Paul says that he, only because that they are still lacking in their faith.
Mm.
That's amazing, they get what else you want to see, Paul.
Mm.
For me, it looks like they are perfect Christians, but Paul is still saying, I want to see what's lacking in
your faith. Hmm. Hmm.
But the letter doesn't indicate what else is lacking in your faith.
Well, and that is a great observation, Ishor, because where does Paul constantly turn when he goes to evaluate and to even speak of his primary aim, his primary objective for the Thessalonians? Does he think of here and now? Does he say that the real litmus test is where they're at today? Or does he point somewhere else, right? He points to on the day that Christ comes back. So for Paul, right, we're all on a continuum, on a path to that day. And it's not until that day that we're done. And on that day, when God removes sin and we're fully united to Christ, now the course is over. So until then, there's always something lacking. And it raises for me the question of, like, whoa, if that's true of these Thessalonians, who, remember we talked a few weeks ago about growth and maturity, how it's not just about time. Here's a group of folks who haven't had very much time to mature, yet are very mature in terms of their faith, withstanding the persecution, spreading the gospel, and yet they haven't arrived either. There's still room for them to grow, still room for them to mature. And we see some of those as the letter progresses on, right? They've got concerns about what happens if someone dies before Jesus comes back. What should we do when people are dying around us, people we care about, and we want them to be there on the day when Jesus comes back? They've still got room to grow, just like we do. Great, great observation, Ishwar. Yeah, Jack.
Something I thought that was interesting, or the way I read it anyway, whether it's actually there or not, Paul would build them up, and then he'd instruct them, and build them up, and then...
Yeah, that's a great pattern, okay? He comes and is warm, very parental, uses even great imagery in drawing them into relationship, and then from relationship moves to teaching, to instruction, to address the issues. I'll never forget one of my professors. He was teaching us how to grade. It was me and one other guy, and he was saying, I want to teach you guys how to grade exegetical papers, you know, for seminary students. And his whole thing was, you always start by finding the good in what they've done. And he's like, I don't care how bad this paper is. You cannot move to criticism until you've at least dropped one good. And it has to be honest. You can't just, you know, make it up. Yeah. So you'll notice, right, in your comments on the back of your paper, I will always start with a few good things before I move to some areas for improvement.
Is nice try really a good thing?
Yeah. Nice try. Good effort, right? Those are the platitudes that I like to throw out. No. That's a great observation, Jack.
Because he finds out from Timothy that they didn't get it. And so he gets the word that, well, these are the points you didn't get, so let's just kind of go back and go over this. There are about three or four points.
Yeah, very good. So take heart, right, for those of you that maybe the first time you hear a sermon or the second time you hear a sermon, you don't totally get all of it. Neither did the Thessalonians. It took two letters and a messenger to at least get them halfway sorted out. Excellent. Well, I trust you're enjoying going through 1 Thessalonians. I really believe when it comes to discipleship, if I were to pick one letter in the New Testament that is most pregnant with import and meaning for discipleship, it's 1 Thessalonians. Not that other books don't talk about it, but this one, it both relationally hits you. I mean, the imagery and you can just feel the unity and the relationship that Paul had with this church, but also then the theology that is driving that is so powerful as well. I mean, you see these core themes, right? Faith, hope, love. I mean, you ought to hear that echo all through the New Testament. And yet these are the right away in chapter 1, right? Turning from dead idols to serve the true and living God. I mean, this is a theme that goes all the way back into the Old Testament, right? And this is what faith is all about.
The amazing thing about this is that if he was only there 3 weeks, whatever he taught him in those 3 weeks literally turned the world upside down.
Yeah.
What's happening here?
Yeah. Well, and here's what you wonder, right, is the world at that time, persecution is so strong, and persecution is the kerosene that ignites the match of the gospel, and that often the more comfortable a culture gets, because you can see this in church history, right? I'm getting off into another course here, but persecution often will spread the gospel. It's almost as if the harder you push on it, you know, the more it spreads out. You know, kind of like Play-Doh. The more you push it down, the more it spreads and flattens out. It's the same with the gospel. But you take a culture where it's not under persecution, it's not under attack, and it becomes complacent. I think almost immediately of Deuteronomy chapter 8, where God says, listen, you guys have been under the crucible of the wilderness, where life has been hard. Your meal, you're dependent on me for your bread. You're dependent upon me for your water. It's not like you can go and get shoes at the local Payless, right? You're going to be reliant upon me day in, day out for everything. But when you get into the promised land, a land filled with milk and honey, and you eat and you're satisfied and you have all that you could ever want, he says, beware. Beware that you don't forget the Lord your God. Because on the day that you forget, and forget in Old Testament language is not so much like, oh, I forgot to get milk when I was at the grocery store, but it's more, it's a committed action against what you know to be right. Because you'll hear language like God remembered his covenant with, okay? And God isn't losing track of his covenant. It means he's about to act. He's about to do what he said he was going to do. Forgetting is the opposite in the Old Testament. It's often this deliberate, intentional action of going against what you know to be right, to be true, this core relationship, particularly with God. And so it is frequently used of Israel throughout the Old Testament. Okay, I'm preaching all sorts of different sermons than the ones that I've prepared for tonight. But this is great. I hope you enjoy this. Again, this class is all about, I just want to stress this again, it is all about you guys in terms of your study and your own ability to draw nourishment and sustenance from the scriptures. And I want to get you excited in that way, which leads me to just a short, I just want to share just a short, if you've never heard of John Piper, this will at least give you an introduction to the excitement of John Piper in his preaching. But this is just a short clip on how the Bible isn't boring, and then I'm going to have you guys break into groups. But this is classic John Piper fashion, if you aren't familiar with him.
On his behalf, that he has an invitation for you and a gift. God is saying to you, now, I have communicated everything you need to know in order to have godliness and life and be fruitful for me and powerful for me and faithful to me. I have spoken it. I invite you to enjoy it. I invite you to live in it. Not lick this lollipop once every 3 days. I invite you to live here. Hold this, love this, read this, meditate on this, memorize this, day and night. Don't let the world shape you so that this looks boring. God Almighty has spoken. It can't be boring. It can't be boring. We're the problem. He's a Vesuvius of joy and energy and power and wisdom and strength and love and grace and justice and truth. He can't be boring. The world is boring. Avatar is boring. That's not even in the manuscript.
It's so funny. The more I listen to him, he makes a comment about his manuscript about every other sermon I listen to. He goes off manuscript better than anybody I know. Just a little encouragement for you. What a powerful reminder, right? That God has spoken, and he's spoken to us in his word. How could it possibly be boring? Well, let's get in groups of two, and spend just a few minutes here. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to encourage one another with some of the things you're learning in this class, okay? So now I'm not talking like specific 1 Thessalonians, but just we're 4 weeks in, right? And as for some of you, you've studied the Bible a lot, and so some of this is review and maybe not as fresh and new to you, but for others, it may be fresh and new. And there's a great sharing that will happen as you guys just walk through the experience of learning in this class together. So spend a few minutes, we'll say 7 minutes, the Matt Morgan 7 minutes, Brian, which is, you know, like,
well, thank you for saving me the trouble of the question.
Let's see. It's 6:44, so we'll say it'll be 6 minutes, so it'll be 6:50. I went the other direction. So 6:50, spend a few minutes together, and we'll reconvene here in just a few minutes.
Yeah.